Welcome to the new season of the Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Nigar Murtazavi, a journalist and political analyst based in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Today, we'll talk about labor protests in Iran, the labor movement, the relations between the Iranian state and labor workers, and how the state has been managing protests and bargaining with the workers. My guest today is Zeb Kalb, a PhD candidate at the Department of Sociology at UCLA. He lived in Iran for several years, worked there as an economic journalist, and studied at the University of Tehran. Zeb currently researches how the Iranian state relies on labor support, how the state bargains with workers, and also how the state responds to labor protests. We'll talk about today the current state of the protests and also take a look at how it's been going in the past few decades. Zeb, welcome to the Iran Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. So let's first talk about the current state of Iran's labor movement. There's been months of anti-government protest sparked by the death in custody of Mahsa Amini in Tehran. That then was the beginning of months and months of protests, bloody protests across the country. And we saw an intersectional community of protesters, I want to say, joining this mass movement, from university students to teachers at some point, a period of oil workers. There were strikes across the country. But I know you look at the labor movement specifically, and you've looked at periods of labor protests. So talk about how you saw that in relation to this bigger movement, as it's called, the Mahsa movement.
So there have been a lot of labor protests in Iran over the past several years, very high and almost unprecedented levels. And there was a lot of hope, I think, when the Mahsa Amini movement broke out, that these workers would join the protests and would help to turn this movement into a more revolutionary and more powerful movement. But interestingly, evidence that we have on a number of these labor protests in this time period clearly shows that the number of protests actually declines as the Amini movement takes off. There was a lot of hope at the time, and there was a lot of attention to some of these protests that were happening. But given the extremely high levels of labor protests prior to the movement, there was actually a decline compared to the sort of standing average.
And why do you think that is? Why didn't the laborers join? Because we know these protests have had, it's a result of political grievances, economic grievances, social, cultural. So naturally, you would assume one of the major movements of the country would join a mass protest like that, or a mass movement.
Right. And in addition to that, scholars have also shown that contribution and participation of labor in these movements, and in Iran, elsewhere in the Middle East, also in South Asia in recent years, we've seen that workers' participation in political movements is often very powerful and can really make a big difference. So the question of why workers didn't join, I think, is very critical. It's surprising. It's surprising for one reason, because to some extent sanctions were imposed on Iran, specifically targeting obviously a lot of workers and affecting a lot of workers in Iran. And when the movement took off, there was a very strong push by the diaspora, rallying around these sort of calls for workers to join. I remember seeing this sort of general strikes hashtag, I think, was almost the second biggest trending hashtag after the main movement hashtag, which was the Mahsa Amini, on social media. And so even despite all of that mobilization by the diaspora, I remember a lot of my friends were involved in setting up strike funds for workers that could strike and could potentially tap into, resources set up by the diaspora. But still, we didn't see that much protest happening. And so this question of like why that happened is critical and is something I'm trying to address in my dissertation. I think it has a longer history that to an extent goes back to the revolution and many of the institutions that were set up in the post-revolutionary period that sort of tie various groups of workers. And with workers, I don't just mean industrial workers. I also mean teachers. I mean even bus drivers, truckers, to the state. And so to an extent, what we've seen is that these sort of systems of bargaining have remained in place and have to some extent even been renewed and rejuvenated over the past decade or so.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the pattern of these protests. You've looked at how the Iranian state bargains with the laborers and essentially manages their periodic protests. Talk about the past or the most recent periods of protests and sort of this push and pull between the movement and the state and the bargaining and that management per se that goes on.
States, when they're put under pressure, authoritarian states such as Iran's or even more democratic governments would often give concessions to workers. And this is also something we've seen during the Mahsa Amini movement. So there were a number of concessions that were given in special economic zones and free trade zones. Managers were told to pay the late wages on time, which is a huge problem. In Haftapeh, which is a company that's seen a lot of protests in recent years, also the managers paid out the late wages much quicker than they would have otherwise done because of the Mahsa Amini movement. And obviously there was a lot of repression. Like one example is in the case of the education ministry, they warned teachers that if they joined the protest or said anything contentious or unruly, they might be fired. And so, these mechanisms and features of labor-state relations exist in Iran, and repression has existed for a longer time. However, what we've seen is that concessions and repressions are maybe not enough to explain why workers didn't join the movement, for the simple reason that they had a lot of grievances, right? And when I talk to my friends in Tehran, they often sort of dismiss workers' participation, partially because of the Persian word for worker, kargar, has a sort of status connotation, being lower status, lower class. And so my friends would say, of course they wouldn't join a emancipatory pro, women's led movement such as the Mahsa Amini movement. But there's also a lot of other groups, such as teachers, that staged very large numbers of protests, very coordinated and impressive protests in the final years of the Rouhani period and in the first years of the Raisi presidency. But even those groups, and teachers are, it's a very there's a lot of women that are teachers. They're often very progressive. And so one would expect these groups to also be, interested in joining this movement. So we would even have expected teachers to join these protests, and that hasn't happened. I think there are two very important factors that have prevented these workers from joining the protests, in addition to, repression and concessions that have taken place. One is the fact that there are a lot of so-called labor representatives, people who claim to speak on behalf of workers and who are closer to the state. Various government institutions often invite these workers. They are often actual workers. And they invite them, to bargain. And to an extent, they also listen to these demands and sometimes implement them. And you see that, for example, with teachers, there's some of the teachers' unions are quite contentious and very radical. And during the Mahsa Amini movement, there was a lot of attention being paid to one of these organizations, which is called the Coordinating Council of Teachers Associations in Iran, which is a very radical organization. But a lot of the other organizations that exist, or more sort of networks and individual activists, are much less radical, and they prefer to bargain with the government, and they're often able to get certain concessions. So in addition to, you know, there being a wide network and a lot of bargaining between representatives of these labor groups and authorities, these activists also find a lot of meaning. It's meaningful for them to bargain with the government because they often see results, be that at a local scale, sort of short-term concessions, or more at the national level. So in the case of teachers, they have staged a lot of demonstrations in recent years, and the people that end up bargaining with the government on behalf of those teachers, which are quite a few, different groups, and they often vie with each other, but they have made actual differences in terms of determining, for instance, the amount of money that is allocated to the educational budget, or the types of laws that have been approved in recent years. So these demonstrations make a big difference in terms of, what some of these workers are able to get. And certainly if these demonstrations wouldn't have taken place, the plight of these various labor groups would have been much worse. So there is a rationale behind labor protests in recent years. And there is also a process of bargaining between workers and authorities that have led to actual results. And it was very interesting for me to see how a lot of the labor activists that I've talked to and have been following over the past years, actually when the Mahsa Amini movement spread, they really refused to, and otherwise they're very active, for instance, on Instagram, on their social media platforms or in the news. They completely refused to give away any news, to make any public statements. And they just waited it out for several months until the movement had died down. And then they became active again. And they, I think for them, the movement might even be seen as a sort of bargaining chip in which they, are able to press the government for further concessions. And to some extent, we've seen that happening in case of, for instance, the Workers' House and also the teachers' movement in recent months, which have been able to get some concessions from the government again.
Mm-hmm. So, Zeb, I know you also did field work inside Iran. You interviewed many labor officials in the country, trade unionists in the country. I want to note this. And I know very few researchers, if any, have had access to these officials. And you also just recently published a report about the class biases of economic sanctions in Iran. I want to talk about that, how economic sanctions, widespread economic sanctions on the country have impacted, first of all, household consumption and welfare across the society, but how, in a way, it discriminates, or as you call it, sanctions are classist, the various occupational classes that are substantially impacted by these sanctions. And you particularly looked at agricultural workers and state employees who were hit the hardest by sanctions. Talk about overall the report with the findings of this reportist, and then I have some more specific questions.
Great. Yes. So as a, I was a fellow at the Bursan Bazar Foundation, and as a fellow, partially because they are very much interested in sanctions, I'm also interested in labor. We decided to do a report looking at how sanctions have impacted household spending by different occupational classes. For instance, public sector workers, farmers, small business owners, more sort of private sector professional groups, etc. To me, some of the findings of this report really helped me in thinking through you know, workers' movements in recent years. And you know, one of the things that we really see when we look at household spending, so not just aggregate GDP figures, but really how ordinary Iranians spend their money and live their lives, we see that over the past 10 years, and so I look specifically at the period from 2010 to 2020, the changes in spending have really not been equal across these various occupational groups. Overall, there was a decline in about 20% in household spending between 2010 and 2020, which is much more than the GDP decline. And so households were actually hit harder than the overall economy. And so we see that some groups, such as public sector workers and agricultural workers, farmers, cut back their spending by up to 30% on average. Whereas other groups, such as urban manual laborers or private sector professionals, and again, these are, so some of these are more middle-class groups, some of these are more lower-class groups, had actually a much softer landing, cutting back their expenditure by around 15%. And so these findings are important because they, first of all, they show us that workers have really become weakened. They've become sort of structurally weakened, right? They find themselves in a much more financially precarious situation. And that, of course, is going to affect their proclivity towards participating in protests. Anecdotally, and we don't really have any evidence of this, anecdotally, during the Amini protest, a lot of, you know, small businesses, for instance, would say that we're not striking today, but what we're doing, for instance, is we do a credit card strike. You only give us cash for the things you buy from us. Let's not do credit cards because then we're in a way boycotting the state banking system, right? This is anecdotal evidence. Mm-hmm. We don't really have any systemic mm-hmm. evidence on how widespread these things were. But, you know, these sort of little facts point to how desperate workers in Iran were for income and for cash. And that's I think very important in realizing why they were wary and hesitant to join these protests through strikes.
Mm-hmm. Zeb, I know you your report, basically the major focus is on the impact of sanctions, but you would also, the counter argument would be that there is massive mismanagement of resources in the country, despite all of its resources, systemic corruption, especially among the political elite. So how do you exactly measure, when you say the impact of sanctions, how do you separate these various factors that essentially impact the economy and the average Iranian household and average Iranian's life?
That's a good question. Yeah, so methodologically, it's quite difficult to causally separate out the effect of sanctions on ordinary households. And the aim of the report wasn't entirely to separate the sort of pure, unmediated, direct effect of sanctions. The report looks more broadly at how household spending by these various occupational groups has changed over the past decade. And in a way, that gives us a broader, but perhaps also a more, interesting picture of how ordinary Iranians have experienced sanctions and have experienced the economy and have experienced their relationship with the government and to politics. So the way in which I separated out the effect of sanctions practically was by looking at, so we have all of this data collected inside of Iran on household spending. There is a large household budget survey that is fielded every year since the 1960s. It's one of the more credible and reliable surveys in Iran. And we have a very large sample of these households of around 500,000 households over a 10-year period. And the way in which I looked at the effect of sanctions, and again, this is not some kind of unmediated causal effect, is by looking specifically at the years in which these sanctions provoked a much harder shock on households. So when sanctions were first imposed in the early 2000s, they really hit households hard a few months after they hit the economy, because it takes some time for that to change habits and for households to really start being affected by changes in the aggregate economy. And so in 2013, specifically, we saw very significant cutbacks in household spending. And again, in 2018, which is when we know that these sanctions were imposed, 2018, 2019, was a very significant cutback of up to 10% in average household spending. So by looking at sort of these years and comparing these years in which we know these sanctions shock, external shock prevailed, and comparing them to this short period of sanction relief that we have in 2015, 2016, 2017, we're able to get a sense of not only the effect of sanctions, but more generally also the types of policies that the government adopted in response to these sanctions. Because obviously, when a external economic shock hits the country, policymakers adopt certain measures in order to cushion certain groups and alleviate the effects of these sanctions on other groups.
So let's talk more details about these two classes. You specifically looked at agricultural workers and state employees, two interesting categories. Talk about how each of these two classes, let's start with agricultural workers. How do they get severely impacted by these economic sanctions?
That's very interesting. And what I found very interesting, specifically coming from these findings, is that we see two very different groups. One, a rural, often self-employed group, farmers, and the other, an urban middle class, generally also much wealthier group, public sector employees that constitute really this sort of the middle, upper middle classes in Iran. Both of these were affected very strongly by sanctions. In the case of agricultural workers and farmers, their plight was exacerbated by really long-standing neglect by the Iranian state, certain urban biases that Iranian policymakers have long had, in addition to lack of investments in irrigation and infrastructure in recent years that was exacerbated by sanctions, in addition to also droughts and climate change that has really worsened and put a lot of strain on Iranian agriculture. But so what we see and what we see in addition to that is public sector workers that were very much hit by government austerity policies. And what was interesting to see specifically is because we have two rounds in which sanctions were imposed, first in the early 2000s and then in 2018, 2019. And these correspond to two different presidencies, two different types of government in Iran. One is, the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad government, which was generally seen as a more conservative, pro-poor, populist type of government. And the other one during the Hassan Rouhani period was generally seen as more middle class, sort of reformist type of politics. And interestingly, the sanctions that were imposed during the Ahmadinejad period, to some extent, the Ahmadinejad government took measures to actually cushion his base, so poorer groups, lower income groups, from the effect of these sanctions. That was not necessarily entirely planned. Some of these discussions were going on in relation to reforming the subsidy system. And so especially the decision in 2012 to implement the universal cash transfer system really effectively cushioned the impact of sanctions on these lower income groups and protected them, really. While at the same time, the Ahmadinejad government pursued very strong austerity policies against the public sector and against middle class groups. In the case of Rouhani, we would have expected him to protect and advantage his own constituents, the middle classes, which he really tried to do when he managed to negotiate sanctions relief. So after the nuclear deal was signed in 2015, Iran started to get more oil revenues, and the Rouhani government effectively used these additional state resources to pump up the salary of public sector workers. And this also, through a variety, through investment and through budget allocation, is also really supported private sector middle classes. Over the course of the Rouhani period, we see that his constituents were still favored. And he did overall, middle classes did relatively well compared to, farmers and poor income groups, especially in the countryside. However, Rouhani also decided after 2018, when these sanctions were reimposed, to essentially U-turn on many of these pro-middle class policies and pro-public sector policies that he was pursuing in the years prior. Actually deciding on very harsh austerity measures that has hit public sector workers, including teachers, including also the pensioners and, the pension system in Iran, very harshly. And so it's important to note, these cross-class protests by more provincial and lower class groups, which have protested against, a sort of decade, really since the early 2010s, after this cash transfer program was created. They have really seen a lot of their claims and welfare transfers from the state reduced, and the state has adopted a lot of measures that has cut subsidies to them. But also in the last years of the Rouhani period, we've seen a lot of protests by more middle class labor groups, right? Teachers, pensioners, and I think it's useful to see those protests specifically in relation to them being part of the Rouhani government to some extent, having a claim on policymaking within the government, but also after sanctions were reimposed, being very much marginalized and having and facing strong austerity and a strong opposition by government policymakers.
Zeb, you also, in your report, there is a chapter on how, despite sanctions, policymakers extended social protection, as you briefly mentioned, that we know sanctions have negatively impacted Iran's healthcare system, its welfare state. For example, sanctions have made it more difficult or expensive to import specific types of medicine, life-saving specialized medicine, or sanctions-related austerity has impacted services and social protections. But you also see an expansion despite that negative impact. Can you elaborate more on what you found in that?
Yeah, so a lot of, studies have already pointed to how healthcare, the healthcare system, and Iran's welfare system has been affected by sanctions. And this is not too surprising to the extent that, trade restrictions, but also lack of state resources affect the functioning of government bureaucracies. So the Iranian government has preferred to not cut back on a lot of the measures and a lot of the welfare institutions that it has built up over the past years. It doesn't do that because it knows that those decisions are very contentious and can provoke protest and opposition. Instead of doing that, it usually just lets inflation do its work, and taking account of the decline of the real value of these programs, it saves money. And so, for instance, that's what we have seen in terms of the cash transfer program, which started in the early 2010s. It was a very large-scale, universal program that really made a very big difference for a lot of ordinary families, and especially poor-income families in Iran. And the government has preferred to keep the amount of money that households get roughly constant. There have been a few top-ups, but overall, these have been very minor in comparison to very high levels of inflation. And so what we see is that the Iranian welfare state, to an extent, is what one can say robust and persistent. Many of the measures that were approved have remained there, and the government has been very wary and still is quite wary. Even though it is making changes to the welfare system, it is adopting reforms in order to cut back on expenses. At the same time, we see that many of these institutions that were developed, you know, after the revolution and were introduced before the revolution have also persisted over time, and the government hasn't been able to eliminate them. This is important because workers often still make claims about these protests. So, for instance, in the case of Social Security, which is very much employment related in Iran, a lot of the labor protests that break out are about the lack or the inability of the Social Security organization, Iran's main state pension fund, to pay out wages or failing to, you know, appropriately update pension benefits. And so workers have used these welfare rights, which are inherited, you know, from previous struggles and from previous movements by the state to expand welfare. And they have used these rights against, often against the government, and often to make claims on authorities. And so I think this is very important moving forward, because workers have these rights. They're pushing often for an expansion of these rights, which even during the period of sanctions, the government has been able and willing to give when it was trying to court popular support. In the case of Rouhani, during his campaign, and part of his popularity derived from you know, a sort of Obamacare program that he introduced, and which was quite effective in its first years. And so it's very important to realize these intersections between welfare politics and popular and electoral politics in Iran. And I think recently what we've been seeing is wariness on the part of a lot of political elites in Iran to participate and to keep these elections competitive, because they see that creates certain bottom-up demands that they have to respond to. And so instead, we've seen, rather than you know, a tightening and a narrowing of the political field, much less competitive elections, and even 2021 presidential elections, you know, were widely boycotted and had very low turnout. And instead, workers have very much taken to the street to express their demands as a sort of alternative route to make claims on the government and to protect the rights that they have inherited from previous periods.
Mm-hmm. And Zeb, finally, you conclude in your report, you elaborate on the implications of your findings for Western policymakers, how waves of protests, including the most recent one that we talked about, have raised questions about the roles of sanctions in the quest for democracy and rights, various rights movements, accountability in Iran, and essentially how sanctions negatively impact or hurt the standing of ordinary Iranians, the various movements, women and minorities. Talk about this conclusion, essentially the implications of your findings for any policymakers who may be listening.
Yes, so I think there was a lot of hope when sanctions were imposed. Some moments it was less explicit, sometimes by some policymakers it was more explicit, for, you know, these sanctions to push and direct social movements in Iran against the government and in favor of more democratic policy change. And so what we've really seen over the past decade is a lot of social movements. It's undeniable that sanctions have really contributed to a lot of social instability and unrest in a variety of ways in Iran. in a way, reinvigorated the Iranian labor movement and labor movements consisting of these various labor groups that have often staged protests quite separately. And it's led, and contributed indirectly, perhaps, to the Amini movement. However, and I think this is critical, sanctions have also really weakened workers over the past decade. And they have created a situation in which some workers are able to stage protests. These are often workers that have become incorporated into the Islamic Republic after the revolution, and they have these systems of and ways of bargaining with the regime. But a lot of other workers are not able to stage these protests. And so, secondly, there is a question of how these movements are able to come together. And this is really a critical question because, the Amini movement was a revolutionary moment. And these moments are very rare, moments in which around a certain issue, a certain topic, the entire society comes together and is able to launch a very widespread movement against the government, which is what happened during the Amini movement, uprising, I should say. And so the fact that workers, often as citizens, they might express sympathy and solidarity with the movement, but their inability to protest as workers, their inability to come together collectively to stage strikes or to stage large-scale demonstrations, which would have inevitably changed the entire characteristic in the end, the nature of the movement itself. That is very critical. And I think especially under sanctions, one could argue that workers play a very important role fundamentally in political movements that can fundamentally reshape the politics of the country. And so the fact that workers did not join this movement, I think, should cause reflection on the way in which we impose sanctions and the way in which these sanctions might deprive certain groups of resources that in other settings they might have used to actually use against the government. So one conclusion that we raise in the report is that, while sanctions have had certainly effects on Iran, they might have not been effective in the sense that we were expecting them to be.
Mm-hmm. I want to add also in your report that Iran's policymakers also carry huge responsibility for how they adopt or counter these economic sanctions, and essentially how both reformists and conservatives, as you mentioned, Ahmadinejad and Rouhani, these two governments have responded to sanctions by actually cutting their commitments to the core constituents and support groups. As you say in the report, a feature of an increasingly authoritarian and unaccountable state. Well, on that note, Sepp, I want to thank you so much for joining the Iran podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me once again. It was a pleasure.
Thanks. That was Sepp Kahl, a PhD candidate at the Department of Sociology at UCLA, who works on the Iranian state-labor relations and how the state bargains with workers in response to labor protests. And thank you for listening to the Iran podcast. You can find us on all major podcast apps, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google, and the rest. So please subscribe to us and leave a review and rating. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we post about new episodes and guests. Our Twitter handle is at Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Murtazavi, and until next week, goodbye.